This week, we wanted to take a minute to talk to you about Patreon. You guys probably hear us talking about it in every show when we thank our newest supporters, but what exactly is it?
Patreon is an exclusive platform that allows fans to pay their favourite creators a monthly amount in exchange for exclusive access and extra content.
And we have so much to offer you over there. When you sign up to our most popular tier, you get access to a full-length bonus episode of Seeing Red, released on the last Friday of every month. You get access to our brand new fortnightly Patreon-exclusive podcast, Crime Wave, in which we discuss topical true crime stories making the news. But that's not all. You also get access to our True Crime Book Club, which meets virtually every 3 months, and entry into our exclusive competitions.
And that's not all, Mark, because there's loads of other benefits too. Thought I'd do that like a show host. But there's also early release ad and sponsor-free episodes of Seeing Red, access to our monthly blog posts, and a mid and end season roundup of the show with us just chatting about the episodes that we've covered and what went on last season. And all of this costs you less than the price of a pint of beer. For just £3.50 a month, not only do you get all of this stuff that we've talked about, all this extra content, but when you sign up, you'll also get exclusive Seeing Red postcards signed by us and some stickers.
There's no minimum commitment, and all of the bonus content can be streamed through the Patreon app, so you can listen anytime, any place. And actually, some podcast providers like Apple Podcasts even allow you to stream the bonus content directly through their platform, so you just listen to it in the same way that you would listen to the weekly episodes of Seeing Red.
It takes just 2 minutes to sign up on Patreon, and when you do, you will find that you've opened up yourself to a whole new world of Seeing Red. And I nearly sung that, Mark.
You definitely wrote it like
it was a song. I'm not going to put people through that. So if you're interested, guys, please head over to patreon.com/seeingredpodcast. And we do like to thank all of our newest Patreon supporters every week, because genuinely, we're so grateful to anybody who's able to support us in this way. It just means that we can keep going with the show and keep producing this. So this week, we've got a huge thank you for
Imran Patel, Gemma Collett, Rianne Stewart, Hayley Bailey, Bogdana Peaver, James Bancroft, Laura Iceman, Jenny Hayes, Ashley Kirkpatrick, Jeanette Estrand, Esme Finlay, Nicola Endicott, Jenny Lee Hunt, Julia, and Aoife. Thank you to each and every one of you, and of course to all of our existing Patreon supporters too. This week's episode has been inspired by my recent trip to Las Vegas, and I'm really hoping that doesn't make me sound like a monumental bellend.
It does.
I thought it might do, yeah. So, apologies. But interestingly, we have been there once before on this show when we covered the 1996 murder of Tupac Shakur, which happened on the famous Las Vegas Strip.
And I loved listening to that episode because it was one that I didn't do with you. And
yeah.
I don't know if I said to you, but I didn't realise how fit Tupac was. Never really knew anything about any of those people. And it was only when I then was looking at pictures and stuff. Gorgeous. Absolutely gorgeous. Just throwing that out there.
I can't believe that was your takeaway from it. From all that hard work I put into it.
All of your hard work. But no, I did enjoy that episode. If anybody hasn't listened to it, it was really interesting because it was something I didn't know anything about. So,
I knew nothing about it. And a film distribution company contacted us and said, we're distributing a film about this whole kind of thing. Are you interested in sort of collaborating and doing a bit of an episode on it? And I was like, I wouldn't normally cover something like that because it just didn't really interest me. All of that kind of music culture wasn't my scene. And I knew nothing. So I found it really interesting to cover it. I really enjoyed it. And I enjoyed kind of going to Vegas, metaphorically speaking, for that one. But yeah, we're back again. And this time we fast forward 21 years to 2017 as we head to the southernmost terminus of the Strip to discuss the deadliest mass shooting committed by an individual in US history. This is the story of the Mandalay Bay Massacre. So before I get into the events of October the 1st, 2017, I just wanted to set the scene a little bit. If you're not familiar with Las Vegas's infamous Strip, it is essentially a 4-mile stretch of Las Vegas Boulevard, which is a 50-mile long road running through the Las Vegas metropolitan area of Clark County in Nevada. The Strip is home to dozens of world-famous hotels and casinos, such as the Bellagio, Caesar's Palace, where Adele was supposed to be performing right now, and of course the MGM Grand, where Tupac Shakur spent his last night on this earth watching that Tyson fight. You know, the one where someone in the audience is holding an iPhone, even though it's 1996. Have you heard of that conspiracy?
I've seen the pictures, and I mean, if you're told that that's what it looks like, it does look like it, but there's a lot of pictures like that, aren't there, through history, where it looks like people are holding something that it shouldn't be. I think it's just because we see that and it's what our minds will see. But I don't believe that there's a time traveller in that photograph, personally.
No, I'd like to think that time travel is possible, but I don't think it's presented itself at that Tyson fight in 1996. And that's a whole other subject we can get onto at another time, as well as like flat earth and stuff. Anyway, whether you've been there or not, you will know of the Las Vegas Strip, of course. You'll have seen it in films like Ocean's 11 and The Hangover, and it's where all of the action is at, and it's debauched and depraved and fun and fantastic. A super weird place, and I never want to go there again.
It just seems crazy to me. I think somebody said to me once that you just never know what time of day it is when you're inside and stuff. Everything's just always on and non-stop, and it's really disorientating. And I don't think I'd like that.
They say New York's a city that never sleeps, but really I would say it's Vegas, because you're absolutely right. You can live your life in an upside down way and sleep in the day and do everything you need to do at night. It's just weird. So it's a perfect backdrop for today's episode, actually, and for the actions that the individual at the centre of it took, because, you know, that's very difficult to understand, and so is Vegas. So the Strip runs from Sahara Avenue, which is home to the Sahara Hotel and Casino, all the way down to Russell Road, home to Mandalay Bay, the 43-storey luxury hotel and resort which serves as the backdrop to today's case.
If there was ever a bit of an episode that I think would give us trouble, I didn't think it would be the word Sahara for you. Crikey, Mark.
I'll cut all of that out, but that took me three times, guys, to
bless you.
To say.
It was hilarious. So, it's usually me.
Usually it's you fucking up, so this time it's me. Mandalay Bay opened its doors on the 2nd of March in 1999. This 3,200-room hotel cost $950 million to build, and it was plagued by problems during its construction phase, not least the uneven settling of soil beneath its foundations, which had caused it to sink by 17 inches before it had even opened its doors. And they did fix that problem by pumping about $10 million worth of shit into the earth's core, and they were able to open. But the rumours still persist that Mandalay Bay is sinking, which is interesting. So if you Google that, loads of stuff will come up on the internet.
Well, that's weird.
I know. Following this inauspicious start, the resort went from strength to strength and welcomed millions of visitors from all over the world in the years that followed. And I deliberately call it a resort because that's exactly what it is. Mandalay Bay isn't just a hotel and casino. According to its website, it's a unique destination resort set on 120 lush acres on Las Vegas Boulevard, with an 11-acre pool paradise featuring real sand and a wave pool. And it also plays host to world-class entertainment at its 12,000-seat arena, and it boasts award-winning dining by celebrity chefs, even has its own nightclub, a shark reef aquarium, a shopping mall, and most interestingly of all, not, a 2.1 million square foot convention centre. So this is a massive site.
That's really mad, like a shark reef aquarium. Bizarre, isn't it?
Yeah,
all
it's Vegas, isn't it?
All of this in Las Vegas. I mean, that's the thing about Vegas, isn't it? It just go crazy.
Any old shit goes. So it sounds impressive, doesn't it? But actually it's not. It's a bit of a shithole, really, which maybe that's unfair. It's not, I suppose. But from the outside, it looks like this really impressive building. It's encased in gold-tinted glass, and the whole building kind of shimmers when the Las Vegas sun bounces off it. It looks expensive and classy and ritzy, but when you set foot inside, it's a bit of a different story. So I visited basically as a grief tourist, and I'm not sure how I feel about that, but I'm just being honest. Maybe that's one to discuss now, maybe another time, I don't know. Anyway, I knew that I've known I've wanted to cover this case for at least a year, and I knew that Mandalay Bay was very much at the centre of the case, and I knew I had to go there and see it for myself. And yeah, I was there like 10 days ago. I had a good look around, and I suppose from a purely shallow perspective, I would say the collar and the cuffs don't match on this one. So it looks amazing from the outside, but the inside is just a bit tacky and a little bit tired. But moving away from the aesthetics of it, maybe because I knew the history of the building, it was weird being there, being inside, being on the gaming floor, for example, knowing that the man at the centre of today's case, who wreaked such havoc on hundreds of people in Las Vegas in 2017, knowing that he had stood on that same floor, going to the lobby, knowing that he had checked in at that lobby, it just felt weird, and I could really feel that sense of it. And I'm sure most people wouldn't feel that. People that don't know about the history or aren't consciously thinking of it might not feel that, but I could really feel that in the atmosphere there.
It's a weird one, isn't it? Because I also don't really know how I feel about, what did you call it, grief tourism, which I think is a really good way of describing it, because ultimately, it's an interesting part of history. The history and the story around it, and as we're going to find out from you discussing this case, isn't nice. It's not good history, but it's still something that happened that is interesting to people. And I think as long as you're doing it in a respectful manner, I mean, if you wouldn't ever do this, but imagine if you'd led on the floor and gone, oh, take a photo of me pretending to be a victim, like that sort of thing, that would be horrific. But I think to just go there and to have a look and immerse yourself and remember, because I know what you're like as a person, I know you will have thought of those victims, and I know you put on social media that you'd lit a candle for people. And I think as long as you're doing it in a respectful way, I don't have an issue with it. I've never personally gone to anywhere. And I don't know how I would feel if I was in that situation, but I don't have an issue with it when people, I don't even really have an issue when people go and visit a grave or something either. I don't really mind it, because I just think they're just being interested in something that has happened, and we need to remember things.
Yeah, I think you're right. And that's what it's about. And as long as it's done in a respectful way, I think when I think about it now, I don't have a problem with it, but I think it does open up a debate. So I'd be really interested to know. To know our listeners' thoughts on that one. Stephen Paddock was born in Iowa in 1963 and grew up in Arizona and Los Angeles. His childhood was marred by his father's frequent and often long-term absence from the family home, more of which in a minute, and while his mother attempted to make ends meet, it was Stephen who was tasked with helping to bring up his three younger brothers. Stephen's father, Benjamin Paddock, was a notorious bank robber who was once featured on the FBI's most wanted list.
Do you think that's like a bit of a badge of honour?
No, I don't.
For people
actually.
In that circle, do you not?
No, and I will come on to that in detail. It's a really interesting point. It can be, but in Stephen's case, this wasn't a badge of honour. It heaped shame on the family and went on to have a lasting impact on how he lived his life.
It's so interesting how some people will go one way or the other, isn't it?
Yeah. So Stephen's father, Benjamin, was seldom successful in his criminal endeavours, and he spent most of Stephen's childhood either incarcerated or on the run. And I think the reason he was on the FBI most wanted list is because he'd managed to escape from jail and was on the run then. So, you know, he might have been a shit criminal, but he was pretty good at breaking out of jail, which is pretty impressive. Benjamin was an absent dad, and Stephen saw the impact this had on his mother, Dolores. She worked really hard to keep the family together, to keep a roof over their heads, but money was tight in the Paddock household, and Stephen vowed that he would become self-sufficient in adulthood so that he would never have to suffer on the breadline again. And he made good on that vow. After graduating from university, where he achieved a degree in business admin, Stephen Paddock became a successful auditor, working for a number of government agencies. He also became somewhat of a land baron, buying up property and land in Panama City, Hollywood, and Texas, and he made serious money in the process. As the property market boomed in the 2000s, Stephen became a multimillionaire, and boy, did he know how to live the high life. Quite literally. He gained his pilot's license in 2004 and immediately bought two small planes. He also enjoyed lavish holidays to the Middle East and the Philippines, where his third wife was from. But most extravagantly of all, he would regularly drive the 80 miles from his home in Mesquite, Nevada, to Las Vegas, where he would spend tens of thousands of dollars gambling at Mandalay Bay.
See, that feels like a bit of a juxtaposition for me, because he's made this vow about never being on the breadline, but then he's risking his money. But he's done amazingly well, hasn't he? He's gone above and beyond what you'd expect when someone says, I just don't want to be poor.
Yeah.
He's gone way over the top.
He was, I'll come on to it in a bit of detail a bit later on, but he was quite a successful gambler, to be honest. So
yeah.
I would say he was a professional gambler of sorts, and quite often won. I would say he won more than he lost, although that wouldn't always be the case, but most times he would win big. And
wow.
Yeah, he was an avid gambler, and he wasn't considered a whale, which would be described as a high roller who gambles consistently high stakes, but he was well known to the staff at Mandalay Bay, and he was very well looked after by them on his frequent visits. He would be given free suites to stay in, he'd get free food and drink, and of course, you know, he was a really good customer to them, and the hospitality staff at the hotel did everything within their power to make him feel special and valued. And I just wanted to talk about this term whale, because that's what these kind of serious gamblers are referred to as. And it got me thinking about the episode I did a couple of weeks ago, Burglary in the Extreme. I think it was episode 2 of this season. And do you remember? I think her name was Maria Mester, and she was an alleged co-conspirator in a number of high-profile burglaries in London. And she was also a high-class escort, high-class sex worker. And she would refer to her clients that had loads of money as a fat goose, which I just loved. And I thought, I just love how we have these sort of animal-type references for people that splash the cash. So I just thought it was interesting.
We do love an animal themed nickname, don't we?
Well, totally, yeah.
As humans, it's mad, isn't it?
Yeah. So Paddock's game of choice was video poker, which he would play on the casino floor, but because it's a solitary game, isolated from most gamblers within the casino, he went unnoticed by the general public. So he would just kind of sit at his little, on his chair with the kind of screen there, and people would be around him, but you wouldn't be interacting with any other gamblers. And I think, yeah, he would have gone unnoticed absolutely by the general public.
He wasn't one of those people stood there going, screaming when he hit jackpots and stuff like that. He'd have just been doing it for himself.
Absolutely. And it was weird with me going into Mandalay Bay, going onto the casino floor, knowing that Paddock would have spent probably hundreds of hours on that floor, and knowing that he had stood where I was standing, it was a really weird feeling. But yeah, had he been playing at the tables, he would have definitely been known. Certainly, I think within the Las Vegas gambling community, people would have seen how much money he was wagering, because it was tens of thousands of dollars at a time, and that would have got him noticed. But I think he liked playing video poker because it was far more private than playing at the tables, and he didn't want a reputation as a high roller. Paddock was, as I said, often really successful when it came to playing high-stakes video poker. And one friend described him as intelligent and methodical, and said that Paddock had boasted to him of applying algorithms to gambling machines in order to win. So whether that's true or not, I don't know. But either way, Paddock was an intelligent guy, and he played with high stakes. And often, yeah, he did absolutely win. But he didn't win at everything in life. In 2015, after years of making money on the property market, Paddock suffered a number of financial setbacks that saw him lose a considerable portion of his wealth. And of course, this was a big deal for him. It would be a big deal for anyone, of course, but don't forget, with Paddock, his accumulation of wealth had been intrinsically linked to the poverty he had lived through as a child. For him, having money wasn't just about being able to amass stuff. It represented a sense of security and self-worth. Without it, he was that little boy lost, the kid from the damaged home, with shame heaped upon him thanks to his father's criminal behaviour.
This is kind of one of the reasons I was surprised to hear that he was into gambling in such a big way, that he'd be willing to risk what he'd built up. So it's so interesting. It was one of the things I thought is such a complete opposites person. Yeah. It's really interesting.
You think, why would he risk that financial security that he'd worked so hard to build up when it's so important to him? I mean, he was clearly a compulsive gambler, so it was a compulsion, I would say, something that he didn't have as much control over in the same way that you can be addicted to drugs. So there was probably an element of that he couldn't control it fully, but also the game that he was playing, video poker, there is an element of skill there, and there is probably a more limited risk than lots of other games. So I guess it was a calculated risk for him, and it was one that paid off. So losing this money around 2015 is really important to the story, because it's only 2 years later that we see Paddock stood at the window of his 32nd floor suite at Mandalay Bay, ready to unleash merry hell on a crowd of 22,000 country and western fans just half a kilometre away. And yeah, I really think this financial meltdown must have had a bearing on his actions that day. 6 days before the shooting, on the 25th of September in 2017, Stephen Paddock arrived at Mandalay Bay and checked into room 32135, a complimentary suite on the 32nd floor. Over the next 6 days, he brought a total of 22 suitcases and bags into his suite, having to make several trips home to transport them all to the hotel, because it would have basically taken a whole lorry to get them all there in one go. He was assisted by bellboys at the hotel with his luggage, and no one noticed the colossal amount of bags that he was bringing in. And I do understand that. This is a massive hotel. There would have been thousands of staff working there. There would have been different staff on different shifts every time Paddock went in and out of the hotel. So I doubt, for example, that the same bellboy ever handled his luggage. And I'm not blaming any one person here, other than Paddock himself, obviously. And I do think we need to discuss the subject of corporate responsibility later, which we will do. But I just want to talk about, you know, this is a massive amount of luggage, 22 full-sized suitcases and bags. And when I say bags, I'm not talking about shopping bags. These were proper luggage bags, which were the size of a suitcase. And if you hadn't guessed already, these cases and bags contained a small arsenal of weaponry, which included 23 rifles and one handgun, as well as a whole host of other weapon-type shit, like thousands of rounds of ammunition, weird cartridge-type things, telescopic things, bipods, which I'd never heard of those before. I'm guessing that's like a tripod, but with two legs, and you rest your rifle on top of it so that you've got some stability. And yeah, just like a whole load of associated shit. And it's just unbelievable what he brought into that hotel.
The thing is, though, is I do agree. I think it's the sort of place where people are in and out all the time. You're seeing different staff members. It's not unusual to see someone with a pile of bags on a luggage trolley thing. Unless you've got someone who's a staff member who's spotted someone doing this numerous times, it's not going to be that unusual in a hotel lobby to see this. What I would say, though, that I do find weird is that these would have then been in his room. So slowly but surely his rooms get, well, I suppose it's a massive suite, so maybe it doesn't get filled with stuff, but it just seems very odd. And yeah, I wasn't surprised then to hear that that's what was in there. You're in a very sweary mood today, I would just like to point out.
Oh, apologies. Yeah, sorry for my potty mouth.
You're in a very sweary mood. I don't know what's going on, but it
just
is.
Fancied
it's a
it.
Weird, do you? It's just a weird just selection it. Of like loads and loads of gun-related shit, as you would have said. And
yeah,
it's terrifying. It's actually terrifying that he's bringing this in unnoticed.
I think that's the right word for it. It is terrifying, the arsenal of weaponry that he's brought into that hotel. I don't understand all of the associated stuff. So I've tried to look it up and understand what it's called, but some of it doesn't make sense to me. But I thought exactly the same. You know, he's brought all of this into the hotel, and he was having the room serviced at this point, and he must have just very carefully hidden all of this within the suite. But really carefully, because you wouldn't want to risk a maid opening a cupboard and unleashing 23 rifles. So I don't really know how that worked.
Yeah, it's
but,
so mad.
But yeah, so in the days preceding the 1st of October, Paddock spent his days sleeping in his suite and his nights gambling on the casino floor. 2 days before the attack, he also checked into the directly connected room 32134. And then the next day, so I think this is 1 day before the attack, he then did put 2 do not disturb signs on the doors as he really started preparing everything in those suites. The 1st of October marked the last day of the Route 91 Harvest, a country music festival held annually in the Las Vegas Village. So the Las Vegas Village was, because it doesn't exist anymore, a 15-acre lot on Las Vegas Boulevard, directly across from the Luxor Las Vegas Hotel and Casino, and diagonally across from the Mandalay Bay Resort and Casino. And between 2014 and 2017, it was home to this Route 91 Harvest Music Festival. And this was a massive music festival. 22,000 fans were in attendance in 2017, and it attracted some of the biggest performers in country music. And just to give a little bit more context, Las Vegas Village, the site of this festival, is basically just an open air space. It's nothing fancy. It's basically just a massive car park without any cars in it, although it has lots of cars in it now because it is a car park now. So as I said, the 1st of October marked the last day of the Route 91 Harvest Music Festival. So let's go there in real time. It's just after 9:30 p.m. and country music sensation Jason Aldean has taken to the stage. The festival is coming to a close now. It's Sunday, the 22,000 attendees have been partying hard all weekend and they are likely dreading the long drive home and the miserable return to work tomorrow morning. Jason Aldean knows he needs to deliver a memorable performance and send people on their way with a smile in their hearts. As he chats to the crowd, half a kilometre away and 32 stories up at Mandalay Bay, Stephen Paddock is putting the finishing touches to his grand master plan. Having already set up a camera on an abandoned room service cart down the hall from his adjoining suites, he's keeping an eye on the comings and goings outside. But there's no one about. He looks around his suite and takes in the scene before him. There are guns everywhere. Piles of what looks like masses of black metal. On the bed, in the bath, on the floor, it just doesn't look right. The cold hard metal is in stark contrast to the plush furnishings which adorn the room. Paddock has everything in place now. The bipods are set up at the windows, rifles atop, ammunition all around him. He stares out of the floor-to-ceiling window and towards McCarran Airport. It's only 600 metres away. Glancing to the left, he stares down at the huge crowd who are now singing along to Jason Aldean's million-selling hit, When She Says Baby. Cringe.
That's country.
Paddock knows it's now or never. He has bottled this before, numerous times, but this time it's different. He knows he needs to smash 2 of these massive floor-to-ceiling windows, and he knows that this is the do-or-die moment. Once he rains down the first blow with his hammer, there is no going back. After all, how would he explain that to the hotel management, not least the authorities? One smash of the glass is all it will take and the rest will follow. That's all he has to focus on. And before he can even consciously register what he's doing, he begins to smash at the first window with his hammer. Within seconds, he has made a hole that is several feet wide and around 6 feet high. This is no longer a window. This is a door. If he wanted to, he could quite literally step through it and into an abyss, towards certain death. But of course he doesn't. He stands there and surveys his handiwork. The cool outside air blows into his suite. There really is no going back for him now. Paddock races towards window number 2, which is a couple of metres from the one he's just blown out, and he smashes a huge hole in that one. Taking a second to compose himself and to get his breath back, he almost expects to hear knocking at his door, the sound of sirens perhaps or screams from someone below. But there's nothing. Nothing but the thud of the music, which he couldn't hear before, but is now loud and real as the bass penetrates his suite through the open windows. Wow, this is real. This is really happening.
This is crazy as well that nobody's aware of what's happening above them. That's what's so mad.
Because I thought...
Oh, it's horrible.
I'll put a full suite of pictures up on social media and you'll see the holes that he's made in these two floor-to-ceiling windows. And glass would have blown out as he's done that. Some of it would have gone back into the suite, but some of it would have gone out. And I didn't really get an opportunity to look at where it would have potentially landed, but I'm guessing it would have been in an area that wasn't full of people. It might have been just a bit of a grassy area or something. And this was a Sunday night at, 10 o'clock. So there wouldn't have been that many people around on the floor. In Vegas, you tend to be at a venue rather than outside of it, I guess. Down the hall, at this very moment, hotel security guard Jesus Campos is on the phone to his control room, reporting an intriguing discovery. Having been sent up to the 32nd floor minutes earlier to investigate an open door alert, he has discovered an L-shaped bracket screwed into the door and the door frame, which is preventing it from opening. This is the door that provides immediate access to the 32nd floor, and it's been effectively screwed shut.
Wow, that's a really clever idea, but that's, again, so terrifying. Like, he's really thinking it through. Like, this is access just to that entire floor.
Yeah. The control room advise Campos they will send maintenance straight away, and as he makes his way towards the elevators, he hears a short, sharp drilling sound. He turns back on his heel, down the corridor, and the noise gets louder. It's coming from room 32135. Campos stands outside for a split second, and as he raises his fist to knock at the door, the drilling noise becomes even louder, and he feels a searing pain in his right thigh. He's been shot. Through the closed door, there's blood everywhere. He's in shock, but instincts kick in, and he limps down the corridor before taking cover in the alcove between rooms 32122 and 32124.
Oh my god, so that drilling noise was a gun, like gunfire.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
Back in room 32135, Paddock is stationed at his bank of bipods with his finger poised on the trigger of one of his 14 .223 caliber semi-automatic rifles, and his right eye is pressed up against the telescopic thingy. He takes aim and shoots into the crowd below, and then he shoots again and again and again. Bullet after bullet rains down on the 22,000 strong crowd. And this is just the beginning. In the shadow of Mandalay Bay, the country music fans enjoying their last few minutes of the Route 91 festival hear a number of loud bangs. It's a kind of popping sound. It's fireworks. Someone is setting off fireworks to mark the end of the festival, surely. But when people look up into the sky, they don't see any bright neon lights to coincide with the banging sounds. This is weird. It's eerie. People are starting to look confused now. The popping noises continue, this time louder and more frequent. Something is seriously wrong, and when Jason Aldean and his band run from the stage mid-song, the popping noises intensify and the crowd surges. This is gunfire, and this is a massive crowd of people. They are being targeted, and it is extremely difficult to make a run for it. Panic ensues.
God, because you can't run away from the direction of where this is coming from.
No, because you don't really know.
You don't know where it's coming from. It's coming from above.
Yeah. And there were other reasons that prevented the crowd from being able to make a quick exit, which I will discuss. Back in room 32135, Paddock is firing between 80 and 100 rounds in 10-second intervals. When one rifle runs empty, he moves along to the next one atop an adjacent bipod before taking aim and caressing the trigger. This goes on for 10.
Oh, my God.
I know. Isn't it just, it's so almost military style in operation, isn't it? He's really put so much thought into this. And I think that was the reason he had so many rifles there, because he didn't want to have to take lots of time setting up a new rifle or rearmoring it. He just needed them all ready to go. So this goes on for 10 minutes, 10 uninterrupted minutes. And since he began shooting at 10:05 p.m, Paddock has fired over 1,000 rounds into the crowd. He has also successfully taken aim at two fuel tanks at nearby McCarran Airport. Fortunately, they haven't exploded. Yet. It's now 10:15 p.m. Time's up. His time's up. He knows he doesn't have long left now. As he glances at the monitor replaying pictures from that hidden camera, he can see a SWAT team assembling in the hallway outside of his suite. Minutes earlier, Campos's colleague had instructed the control room to call the police. Taking one last look at the ensuing carnage below him and imagining the sheer terror on the faces of his now hundreds of victims, the smell of fear in the air, Paddock reaches for his Smith & Wesson revolver and angrily shoves the barrel into his mouth before pulling the trigger. His brain explodes onto the ornate ceiling and his body falls to the floor, with half of his head now missing.
Oh, do you know what? It makes me so angry when these mass shooters do this, because then there's no real justice for the victims. No. There's no real answers. And I get why they're doing it. It just makes me so mad.
Yeah, it's so incredibly frustrating that justice wasn't brought to the victims and their families in this, and that he completely got away with it. And I'm going to talk a little bit about Paddock towards the end and his state of mind, but I think he was quite clearly suicidal. So he was going to take his own life come what may, but he clearly wanted to take out hundreds of others. So back at the Route 91 Harvest Music Festival, the gunfire may have stopped now, but the carnage is only just unfolding. It's clear that this is a mass shooting now. The smell of burning metal and blood permeates the air, and victims lie motionless all around the 15-acre lot known as Las Vegas Village. Minutes earlier, they had been enjoying the dulcet tones of Jason Aldean. Now they are running for their lives. As the crowd surges towards the perimeter of the site, a security fence impedes their exit. Panicked, in shock and completely disorientated, a stampede ensues and hundreds of people are pushed and shoved out of the way, thrown to the ground and trampled. In the days that followed what has become the worst mass shooting by a lone gunman in US criminal history, the death toll would go on to rise to 58. 411 people would be assessed as having been shot or hit with shrapnel, and a further 456 would be assessed as having been injured as a result of this mass stampede.
Jesus. And we've talked before on numerous cases about mass panic and stampedes and stuff, but this is on a huge scale. Oh my God.
This really is, and it reminded me of Hillsborough, where we saw really similar. And yeah, it's tragic because... with this case, something awful has already happened, and then you have this kind of secondary issue of a stampede which caused hundreds of people to be seriously injured. So I will come on to that burning question shortly. Why? But before we do that, I just wanted to focus on a couple of survivor stories. Natalie Gurmit, a 37-year-old ultrasound technician, spoke out on the first anniversary of the attack in a very candid interview with The Cut, an online magazine. It's a really, really powerful article. I'd encourage you to have a look at it if you're interested. In her own words, she said, "Jason Aldean was several songs into his set when we heard some really loud noises. I remember one of my friends said, 'Fireworks.' The next thing I knew, it felt like there was an explosion in my face and that my face was on fire. It kind of just hit me. Okay, you've just been shot in the face and there's still gunshots going on. This isn't over." She went on to say, "We got down on the ground. It was chaos. 22,000 people crying and screaming, not knowing what to do. I was standing stage right, which is where the magnitude of injuries and deaths were. There was a stranger behind me who took a tank top shirt off to hold it to my face. I could definitely tell there was something missing in my face. I thought I'd lost all of my teeth because I felt so much stuff in my mouth, and I thought, oh my God, my face has obviously been shattered into pieces and all of my teeth have been blown off." Later, they explained to me that what I'd been feeling was all of the bullet fragments and bone fragments that were now stuck in my mouth. It was weird because when I touched my face, I didn't really feel anything and I didn't understand it. But later I learned that it was because the sensory nerve had been completely obliterated, so I couldn't feel the touch there, but from the explosion, I could feel the pain." Natalie went on to have numerous surgeries, at least 8, and that was to rebuild her jaw and her face, and she was off work for well over a year. Her jaw had to be wired shut for a period of 8 weeks during the healing process. She couldn't eat during that time, she had to be fed through a tube, and she also said that this had, I don't think it had significant implications on her relationship, but it had some implications on it because her partner felt very guilty that he hadn't been there. And of course, that's misplaced guilt, but that's very natural and very human to feel like that. He hadn't been there and he wasn't there to help her or to save her, and that hit him. Most of the gunshot wounds inflicted on this crowd were on the head or in the face, because if you think about it, Stephen Paddock is firing from the 32nd floor of Mandalay Bay down on the crowd. So they're all stood up. He's not going to get their legs. It's a massive crowd. They're all packed in close together. It's their heads and their faces that are going to get the brunt of those 1,000+ rounds of ammunition. Of speaking out about all of this, Natalie said, "This is so powerful for me. I just hope that when people read this, that they realise that there is always hope to get through whatever you're going through. I think that there are always times in our life that we're going to be given these trials and tribulations to go through, and we don't get to pick them. We don't see them coming. We don't even understand them. But there is a power that comes with finding inner strength and courage to move forward with grace and dignity." And I just thought, I know she's talking about those who had been impacted in this tragedy, but those words can be adopted to any shit that we have to go through, can't they?
Yeah, that's really amazing.
It just really resonated with me. So, you know, very, very brave woman. And I hope that she's gone on to make as good a recovery as is possible. Another survivor, Telemachus Orphanus, a 27-year-old from Thousand Oaks in nearby California, was with a number of friends enjoying the music when he heard shots being fired. And he was lucky. Taking no chances, he and his friends knew it wasn't worth waiting around to have their suspicions confirmed. They managed to escape with their lives, and as the news of the mass shooting landed in the days that followed, Telemachus knew that he'd had a very lucky escape. But fate had other plans in store for him. He may have managed to escape with his life this time, but very sadly, death was waiting around the corner for him. And this is just so incredibly tragic. After escaping the Las Vegas shooting, which is what this is commonly referred to as, he was among 260 patrons and employees at the Borderline Bar and Grill in Thousand Oaks in California, when a lone gunman, Ian David Long, entered the premises and opened fire, killing 13 people, one of which was Telemachus. This was just 13 months after the Las Vegas shooting. Isn't that just a horrific twist of fate?
That is crazy.
It reminded me of those Final Destination films. The Grim Reaper was out to get him, and he cheated death, and it wasn't long before it caught up with him. And weirdly, 60-ish people that had been at the Route 91 Harvest Music Festival the previous year, 60 of those 22,000 people that had been there were actually at the Borderline Bar and Grill in Thousand Oaks on the night of that shooting. Telemachus is the only one who died that night. But how weird is that? 60 of them were there, because it was a kind of country and music venue, restaurant type venue bar. And it's not too far away from Las Vegas. So yes, 60 people had gone through the Las Vegas shooting and now this shooting in Thousand Oaks. So going back to Stephen Paddock, at a press conference on October 4th, Clark County Sheriff Joe Lombardo stated there was evidence, which he declined to discuss, that Paddock had intended to escape the scene and that he may have had assistance from an accomplice. Investigators searched his room and found a bulletproof vest and breathing apparatus, neither of which were ultimately used by Paddock. And actually, you know, I'm not too sure there was an escape plan here. I think that the gas mask and the bulletproof vest was there to just ensure that if the police were battering down his door and firing shots, or they kind of threw something into the room to gas him to stop him firing at the crowd, he could have just kind of continued doing so for as long as was possible. So yeah, I'm not sure that he was potentially looking to escape. I really don't believe that. And he didn't try to escape. And I think he brought that Smith & Wesson revolver with him purely to kill himself at the end of all of this.
Yeah, because it's not the sort of thing that you'd use in the rest of it, so
no,
it makes more sense.
Absolutely not, yeah. At the end of a 10-month-long investigation into the shooting, it was revealed that there was no evidence of conspiracy or actually of a second gunman, and it was ascertained that Paddock's motive had not been definitely determined. County Sheriff Joe Lombardo said, "What we've been able to answer are the questions of who, what, when, where, and how. What we have not been able to definitively answer is why Stephen Paddock committed this act, and we still don't know. Unlike many other mass murderers, Paddock left no manifesto. There was no Facebook or YouTube video of him ranting about the government or spouting some weird ideology. In fact, the only written notes detectives found in his suite at Mandalay Bay were his calculations working out bullet trajectory, wind speed and distance into the crowd below.
Oh my God. Ever the auditor.
He was a true lone gunman. He wasn't representing anyone or anything. So, Bethan, why the fuck did he do this?
It's so bizarre. Like, I get that he's in a bad place, but this is for nobody to have had any sort of pre-warning or to, because usually you'd hear somebody say afterwards, actually, yeah, this came out afterwards, or we knew this about him, but we didn't think he'd go this far, or something. And in the nicest way possible, shit happens to people all the time. People lose money. People have these issues and they don't go and do this. Like, no. This is someone who's planned, and like you said, he's there working out trajectory calculations and stuff.
Yeah.
But then equally, why do any of these psychos do it? Like, it's...
I'd understand if he'd almost brainwashed himself or been radicalised in some way. That would make sense to me, that his cognitive thinking would have been fundamentally changed. But I just, yeah, it just bothers me. But for me, this actually smacks of another mass murder that I covered a couple of years ago in an episode entitled Mass Murder in the Skies, which told the story of Germanwings Flight 9525, which took off from Barcelona Airport, bound for Dusseldorf, with 144 passengers on board, as well as 4 crew and 2 pilots. Half an hour into that flight, the captain left the cockpit to go to the bathroom, leaving his co-pilot, First Officer Andreas Lubitz, alone. He proceeded to lock the cockpit door from the inside before beginning a minute-long descent into the French Alps, killing everyone on board. And I just saw some similarities between this and the actions of Stephen Paddock. So it doesn't necessarily explain why, but with Germanwings Flight 9525, it's very much accepted that this was pilot suicide. And I think Stephen Paddock could very much have been suicidal. I think he'd had, I think he'd always planned on using that Smith & Wesson revolver to take his own life, as I said. And I think his mass shooting at that crowd at the Route 91 Harvest Music Festival was a big fuck you to the world before he bowed out.
I do, but it doesn't explain why. Like,
but he could have been really depressed, and almost he could have been psychotic. And I think with Andreas Lubitz, that was suicide, and he decided I'm going to end my own life, but I'm going to take out a shitload of people with me. And I personally wonder if Stephen Paddock was the same. And it's just this huge amount of internalized anger that I just want to bring people down with me, and a huge fuck you at the world, and maybe going out with some notoriety that would come off the back of it. We don't know. Yeah. That's only my speculation.
This is it, though, because it reminds me of Michael Ryan, the perpetrator in the Hungerford massacre, and no reasoning for that either. Why do they do this? And it is. It's the taking of their own life at the end means that there's no answers whatsoever at all.
No.
And that must be so hard.
Yeah. So I talked earlier about corporate responsibility in all of this, and in November 2017, so just a month after this shooting, a lawsuit was filed on behalf of 450 of the victims of the shooting, which claimed that the Mandalay Bay Hotel had shown negligence by allowing Paddock to bring a large amount of weaponry into the building, which I totally get. I know we talked a little bit about that, and I do see where you're coming from. But I know in the wake of this is something that is monitored more closely in hotels now. So the amount of luggage that residents are bringing in. And there are also signs up at every hotel in Las Vegas saying that you're forbidden from bringing any weapons onto the premises, which they never used to have those. And of course, that's only a sign, but at least it's something, isn't it, I suppose.
I feel like you shouldn't have to tell people
that.
Well,
no, but it is America, isn't it?
Oh, that's actually, do you know what? Yeah, I wonder if what the laws are in that particular state, actually. That's a good point.
Yeah,
but,
I mean,
yeah,
it is different to here. In July 2018, MGM Resorts International, which owned Mandalay Bay, countersued hundreds of victims. This is just obscene, claiming that it had no liability of any kind for the attack. They said they had to countersue the victims. It was just like a legal maneuver. It was nothing personal. But then actually the following year, they reached a settlement totaling $800 million with the victims of the shooting. And that was approved by a judge in September of a couple of years ago now, in 2020. So there's been financial restitution, but of course no retribution for Stephen Paddock's actions. There's a lot more to this case. That brings it to an end, but I just wanted to say there is a lot more to this. There were a number of aborted attempts where Stephen Paddock had looked to plan and execute something very similar in the couple of years before this. I've not gone into those. There's an awful lot to cover off, but there were some abandoned attempts where people had a very narrow escape because he just bottled it. And I made a brief reference to him bottling it previously, and that's what that referred to. Have a look into it.
That is something, because when you said that, I was thinking that maybe gives a little bit more of an information, indication as to why, in that there's not a sensible reason, there's not a genuine reason, but he obviously wanted to do this. He had planned this, to do something like this for years. So it's not even like it was a spur of the moment, this has gone wrong and I'm going to start doing something. He's been planning this. And again, it just makes me so frustrated that we don't understand the reasoning behind it. Like, what mental illness did he have, or what was he going through that made him decide that this was the way to go?
Yeah, and he was drinking heavily, very heavily in the run-up to this, and he was taking diazepam. He'd been prescribed diazepam from his doctor. So there were, of course, issues that he was sort of self-medicating. But yeah, we just don't know why he decided to wreak such carnage. And yeah, he'd been planning this for 2 years. He'd been amassing this arsenal of weaponry. And in previous trips to Mandalay Bay with his wife, he had, according to her, been kind of scoping out the viewpoint from the different suites that they stayed in. She'd become a little bit suspicious, and actually he'd sent her back to her native home country of the Philippines a couple of weeks before he carried out this shooting to kind of get her out of the way. And he'd paid all his gambling debts off and put his house in order. And I just, before we do end, I know Bethan, you wanted to talk a little bit about something from last week, which we'll come on to in a second, but I wanted to try and convey that when Paddock was in his suite, stood in front of those massive windows with that hammer, how it was all about just striking the first blow on that window. That's all he had to do. The rest would follow. He'd have no choice then but to carry out the act. So, and I know I've been in situations like that. I won't bore you too much, but once I hated my job, and I was on some course, and they tried to do some motivational thing of saying, all you need, you don't have to be here. You're all here because you want to be here, and you don't have to have this job. You could leave. And it was like a light bulb moment for me. And I thought, oh my God, I need to leave. I need to stand up and walk out of here and leave this job. And I remember breaking it down as I sat there in this kind of classroom environment with a trainer there at the front of us, thinking, all I actually have to do is stand up. If I stand up, there's no going back then, because that would be really embarrassing if I just stood up and stood there and didn't move. But if I stand up, I know the rest will follow. I'll walk out. I'll never have to go back to that shitty job. And unfortunately, I didn't do it. But I always thought of that. That's all I had to do. And I think with Paddock, I really feel that he must have just stood at that window with that hammer and thought, that's all I need to do. All I need to do is strike the first blow and the rest will follow.
I completely agree. I think this is it. And it's like when people are worrying about leaving like an abusive relationship or a home or something like that. And it's literally all you need to do is get up and walk, or get up and move. And like you said, it's just that first movement. Because once you've done that, there's no going back.
There isn't. That was it. That is it. That is absolutely it. So hopefully I conveyed that. But yeah, Bethan, I know you wanted to talk about your case, which covered three different instances of parasomnia last week.
A few of our listeners got in touch, and I thought people who are happy for me to talk about some of the things that they've said, I thought I'd quickly just read out a couple of them, because they said I was allowed to read them out. We won't be sharing any names or anything, but they were slightly lighthearted, which hopefully will help to take a bit of the edge off of listening to this case. First of all, Kat, who had given the suggestion, then popped onto our Facebook page and she's written a little bit about what made her suggest the episode. I wasn't sure if I was supposed to say her name or not when we did it, so she didn't get a name check, but she's basically said she is such an open book and she's shared her experiences on the Facebook group. So if you're in that, you can have a little look at that about her ex-partner who, in my opinion, terrorized her. Sleep-wise and then also not sleep-wise, but what made her decide to suggest this as a theme for the episode. So that was wow. really interesting. So thank you very much, Catherine, yeah, for sharing for that with us. And then we also have, when I was a teenager just before Christmas, I sleepwalked into my mum's bedroom, told her what she'd bought me for Christmas and that it was broken. So he didn't realise that he'd done this. She only told him after the fact because he didn't know about it. But not only was he right about the Christmas present, it also broke later on Christmas Day. He had no idea he was getting it. So how weird is that?
That's weird. That is, I'm a real believer in all of that kind of stuff.
That really, I was like, ooh, that's so bizarre. And then another one, my most adventurous experience wasn't so bad, but it was embarrassing. So here we go. A bit of a lighthearted one to say thanks for listening to an absolutely horrific case, everybody. So I was about 17 on a high school camp when I sleepwalked from my cabin to another, climbed up a ladder and fell asleep in an empty bunk bed. I awoke sometime later underneath a suitcase. I surmised that someone was playing a trick on me and had hidden my doona or duvet in the bag. So feeling very tired, groggy and annoyed, I started going through the bag, tossing everything out around the room. Unable to find my doona, I got out of the bed, left the room in the dining room of this particular cabin. It was the middle of the night and everyone else was fast asleep. When I woke up, I realised I was in the wrong cabin. I looked back into the room and saw the two sleeping girls were not my buddies, but two strangers. So I hightailed it out of the building and back to my cosy bed. Just leaving this carnage behind. I mean, that's, of honestly, stuff that, all over the room.
Yeah, that's like a living nightmare to wake up in that kind of situation.
So there we go. Couple of bits of lightheartedness just to end the episode. So thank you, guys. Anybody who messaged us or messaged me and shared, really appreciated it. And I did enjoy reading the messages.
Thank you for listening. And don't forget to check out our show sponsor, which is stitchfix.co.uk/red. And also, if you want to and you're able to, support us on Patreon. And if you want to look at all of the exclusive access we have there, just head to patreon.com/seeingredpodcast. And we'll be back next week for something else. We'll see you then. Bye.
Hi, angels. It's your girl, Louise Rumble, and I'm the host of the Open House podcast. Therapy quite literally changed my life and sent me straight into my hot, healing girl era. Now, each week, I share my story, the good, the bad, and the downright juicy, and chat with some of the world's best therapists, psychologists, and wellness experts. From love, sex, and dating to attachment styles, nervous system regulation, wellness hacks, hormone balancing, and more, nothing is off the table. I've emptied my bank account on therapy and healing so you don't have to. So if you're ready to leave the past in the past and build the future you've always deserved, me and my favorite experts are waiting for you on the Open House podcast. Listen now wherever you stream your podcasts, and I cannot wait to meet you.